Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Thea Obrecht, whose novel is titled The Tiger's Wife. It's a first novel. A finalist in 2011 for the National Book Award. Thea Obrecht was born in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, which I believe it was Yugoslavia at the time, and now lives in Ithaca, New York. Before this book came out, you'd written some short stories, so you were already on people's radar. How many short stories do you have?
I have about 5 short stories published, and then, you know, a couple more that are in the, you know, in the tragedy pile.
Well, this book, as you were writing it, you were pretty sure that it was going to get published, I would think.
I actually met my agent through this book, a friend of mine at the MFA program at Cornell, where I was getting my graduate degree, had an agent and sort of mentioned my book to him. And I was in the process of writing it and wasn't really looking to get published at the moment. He was interested and asked me to show him some pages, and I did, and that's how he signed me. So based on his wanting to take me on an incomplete manuscript, you know, I thought that we had a decent shot at something small.
Thea Obrecht, let's talk a little about you and your writing, and then we'll get into specifics of this book. You were born in Belgrade, but you grew up in Cyprus and Cairo, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. We left Belgrade when I was 7. I'm from a mixed family, and at the time, because of the tensions, it was particularly difficult for mixed families to stay and make the choices that non-mixed families didn't have to make. So we left and ended up in Cyprus, where a lot of people leaving the former Yugoslavia ended up in 92. And then after that, Cairo, by way of my grandfather's job.
As you were growing up, did you go back to Yugoslavia or did you stay away until after the war?
My grandparents went back after Egypt to continue living. They had an apartment in Belgrade, and my grandmother still lives there. But we moved on to the States, and actually I went to high school in Palo Alto. I started going back in 2003 after we became naturalized citizens, because you can't leave the country until you get your...
Well, now you've been back and forth, and I understand that in the writing of this book, you spent some time there and learned a lot about the mythology. Let's go to the book itself and your own reading. Now, I understand that your favorite authors... Among them are Mikhail Bulgakov for Master and Margarita,
yeah.
A great book, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Love in the Time of Cholera. That gives you a firm grounding in magic realism. What draws you to magic realism? Tiger's Wife is kind of and kind of not, which we'll go into in a minute. But what draws you to that entire genre?
You know, I think it's the escapism of it. I think that in magical realism, you know, it's sort of... This is such a simplistic way to put it, but it's sort of like animation in film. You can do anything, and as long as it's written in a way that continues telling the story, that's true to the story, you know, it isn't there just for show. It's really part of this world that the author's constructed. You, the reader, can believe anything, and I love that experience as a reader. I love it in The Master and Margarita especially, but it sort of allows a different kind of canvas for the writer as well, so I think that's what draws me to it.
Was it always an implicit part of the novel?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that because I love to read it, it was inherently going to end up in my writing sooner or later. And when the issue of mythology and sort of a regional legend came up naturally as part of the writing process, that's where the book ended up.
Well, you make a specific decision in the book that the actual scenes in kind of, quote, real time with Natalia, the protagonist, who's a doctor, that those sequences don't have magic realism, but surrounding it is a kind of magic realist setting when people talk of the past.
Yeah. That sort of naturally came about simultaneously with the decision to make Natalia and Zora and Natalia's grandfather as well doctors. Because I knew that the line between reality and myth was going to be blurred in this book, but that it was always going to be present. I knew that doctors, you know, were the people in the Balkans who most often have to tread that line. I have several friends who are doctors, and my best childhood friend is one, and so most of her frustrations about her job involve trying to break through that line between modern medicine and traditional medicine. And then this idea of displacement, the displacement of someone who's heavily rooted in the present when they come to interact with a world that's still living in the past. You know, the rules that you have simply don't apply. And there's something, you know, there's something more. There's something ancient there. And, you know, story rules reality.
And the idea of making the grandfather's stories be this mythological story, even though he's a doctor, do you try to stand outside of it and ask the question about what's real or what's not, or have you kind of given up on that?
You know, I feel like I've kind of given up on it because I like reading books that are interactive in the sense that the reader has to make certain decisions in order to close the circuit. That sort of allows the reader to make meaning out of whatever part of the book they want. And I love that freedom as a reader. So I think that as a writer, for parts of this book, I was like, could go either way. I don't know. Maybe it's real. Maybe it's not. It's about, you know, Natalia's trying to make decisions in this book about how she should view her grandfather's life. And then that also becomes a mission for the reader, I guess, throughout the process.
Well, does she actually think that there is a deathless man? This is a guy who haunts her grandfather.
Yeah.
Does she actually think that this man exists?
I think that to some degree, by the end, it doesn't matter whether or not she thinks that he really did exist, because it's a story that she comes to accept about her grandfather. And then that story is reality. So in a way, if you accept the story, then it becomes real. Then it becomes fact.
In The Tiger's Wife, Taya Obrecht, there are several stories within the story, and some of them are not from Natalia's point of view. That brought up the question as I was reading the book. Is she telling the whole story or not?
She is telling the whole story. Again, that goes back to this idea of reality. I mean, those aspects of the story, the parts that involve characters like Luca, the butcher, and, you know, the apothecary, they're told in a voice that's quite factual. You know, there's this sense of underlying magic and mystery.
Yeah, but she can't know this stuff.
That's absolutely true. That becomes the reality in her telling the story that way. I mean, is it pieced together from what she learned by going to that village? Because she does go to the village. Is it the way that makes most sense to her? Is it what people in the village have been saying to her? It's an amalgamation of all those things.
As you were writing it, you were thinking that she was telling it, though.
Yes.
The grandfather carries around a copy of The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling. Why that particular book? Why did you pick that book?
That book was a part of my childhood. It was the first book, one of the first stories that I heard, the first book that I read in Serbo-Croatian when I could read, and then, again, the first book that I read in English when I was learning English. So it had a significant role in my childhood. Its presence in The Tiger's Wife was originally supposed to be quite small. It was just supposed to be a way for the grandfather to understand physically what a tiger is, you know, sort of a shortcut to tigerdom. As the book went on, it became this talisman between Natalia and her grandfather. The physical book itself was, you know, transferred as a way of telling the story, as a way of making meaning out of the grandfather's life, you know, validating what happened with the tiger and the tiger's wife and all these things. And I that came out of nowhere. That just sort of happened as part of the process and quite surprised me.
Well, it becomes serendipitous because of all the animals that are within the book.
That's right.
And they could all be related to The Jungle Book.
That's right, yeah.
And so as you're writing, were there little light bulbs going off saying, aha?
I'm so entrenched in the language often and in the immediacy of the story that for me the light bulbs didn't go on about anything until I got to the end and read it and then started editing it for what it really was. So my light bulbs were late.
Well, when you got to the end, how close was that version to what we're reading here?
Nowhere near. That's the version that is my thesis, actually, and is hidden somewhere on the library shelves at Cornell. But it's quite different because between the draft that was the thesis and then sold to Random House and the final draft, I went back to Serbia and Croatia in an official capacity. I went to hunt vampires and did a tremendous amount of research that inadvertently led to rewriting actually huge parts of The Tiger's Wife, something like 100, 120 pages, completely written from scratch.
I was writing down lists of the superstitions / stories that occur within Tiger's Wife. We have the story of the deathless man, the tiger's wife herself and the tiger, the story of the butcher, Luca, the story of the elephant wandering the streets during the war, and the story of Derisa, the bear man. Were all those stories in there in that earlier version?
They were, except for the elephant. The elephant was not there, and Luca's story was quite different. But the elephant story, which actually, I guess, is a moment that a lot of people respond to emotionally in the book, and it really is a turning point for Natalia's character, that came about because in the original draft, and this was something that I learned about novel writing that I didn't know, in the original draft, the grandfather just sort of tells Natalia the story. You know, there's no rift between them. There's no elephant moment. They're just sort of sitting around the dining table. And I hated this. And even though the book sold with it that way, I always knew that this was something that I really, really wanted to change. And, you know, months and months and months went by, and there were no light bulbs going on. And then I accidentally ended up at Syracuse Zoo during an elephant petting. And, you know, all these flashes went off, and I was like, oh, yes, there'll be an elephant scene, and it'll be in the street. And that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been given, you know, time to rest with the book, as it was in its very bad shape.
Did you ever find out what happened at the real Belgrade Zoo during the war? Was there anything that went on there?
During the war, I know that they protected the zoo. During the war of the 90s, the zoo was protected, and I know that it sort of became a symbol around which people rallied. I mean, they didn't protest outside the zoo with animal hats or anything, but the part about the tiger, the other tiger in the zoo, eating its legs is actually taken from headlines. There was in 99, during the NATO bombing of Belgrade, the animals underwent, you know, massive trauma and shock and sort of these emotional breaks, and it was heavily publicized.
There's a mention of a massacre at Sorobor, mm-hmm. I think, which is, I guess, a fictional town. Was there a real massacre like that?
There were several cities, particularly in Bosnia, but elsewhere as well, that were held under siege for months, even years. One of them was Mostar, my grandmother's birthplace.
This other town is the birthplace of the grandmother in the book, which
That's right.
brings up the question, your grandfather passed away shortly before the writing. And in an interview with that's online with Jennifer Egan, you talk a little about that. What she fails to ask you is, what is the relationship between the fictional grandfather and your real grandfather? When we're reading that, are we kind of looking at an alternate universe version of your grandfather?
Yeah. My grandfather was not a doctor. He was an aeronautical engineer. But I think that I was quite unrealistic about how accurately his real character and the character of Natalia's grandfather line up in terms of patterns of speech, certain things they do, like his little exercises in the morning, all that, you know, and what he might have done. I think that the character is very heavily modeled on him, although the character of Natalia is not really modeled on me, the relationship, but I feel a lot closer in terms of my preoccupations and obsessions to someone like Darisha the Bear.
In one interview, you make the following comment. My extreme compulsive desire to avoid using real places or names and instead capture the war in essence was the reason that you chose to make everything fictional. Why? What is that obsession about?
Two things. One is that when you anchor yourself to history, you sort of get bogged down very quickly in the necessity of certain things having to happen in an accurate timeline. If you're in Sarajevo at a particular point in the 90s, you know, we know what happened then, and that has to be accurate. So I felt that I wanted to free the narrative to be able to be wherever it wanted at whatever time it wanted. It's fiction, so that's okay. And the other reason was that anybody who was watching the news in the 90s got a tremendous amount of information in this very dry textbook kind of way where, you know, you knew the statistics, you knew what was happening to whom and where. There was a lot of finger-pointing. There continues to be a lot of finger-pointing, you know, in the news, but also there regionally. And that was something that I wanted to avoid. I wanted to avoid the historical inventory and tell stories that had to do with human survival, regardless of ethnicity and political stance.
Let's go back to the events, and let's put them in your brain you imagined them to be. Now, the city that Natalia lives in, that's Belgrade.
Yeah.
Where exactly? Is it Croatia that they go to by the seaside? If you were going to kind of put a place on it, what were you thinking?
I was thinking when I was writing those sections of the Adriatic coast of Croatia. Yes.
Okay.
Which is a beautiful, I mean, like one of the most beautiful places on earth, absolutely. And without, you know, without doubt.
And the superstitions that the people in Croatia have, the burying of the bodies and the unburying, is that based on any real superstitions?
That vampire hunting trip that I took was very edifying for me. That body happens to be buried in that particular region, but the diggers themselves, you know, the locals often say that, you know, they're not from around here. They're from, you know, they're from your neck of the woods. There is, in certain pockets of the Balkans, that, you know, sort of, regardless of whether it's Serbia or Croatia or Bosnia or Macedonia, or even Slovenia, actually, there are certain superstitions about traditional medicine, traditional ways of invoking healing from a spiritual power. I've never met anyone who's actually buried a heart. You know, I did take some artistic license, and I don't mean to suggest that this is something that goes on all the time. And if you, you know, dig at a crossroads anywhere around there, you'll come up with, like, a really nice bit of pottery that had a heart in it once, but now it's okay, you know. But there is a stubbornness that I encountered on that vampire hunting trip in certain communities of really adhering to the idea of a curse, the idea of magic as something that you can buy from somebody else, the idea of healing oneself by performing a certain ritual, ritualistic healing. That all culminated in that body in the vineyard.
Let's go back to those different stories that are within the story. You mentioned that all of them in various forms were always there. You tell the story, I think it's in Amazon.com, that you'd been writing a story about a deaf-mute girl and an escaped tiger where Darisa the bear is a minor character, and then you found the real guy.
Yeah, the real guy. That was a fascinating marketplace. My 11th market in Moscow. My parents lived in Moscow for a couple of years, and I got to visit them, you know, twice a year from L.A. He had these pelts. He had these bear pelts. It's this. The market itself is a tourist trap, and it's this maze of, like, little stands with all kinds of cool things on them. And as you get deeper and deeper into the market, the things get more and more sinister. And, you know, you see bits of altarpieces that, you know, kind of shouldn't be there. And if they catch you with them, you know, crossing the border. So there was a guy with a bunch of bear pelts. And it was cool. And my brother was little at the time, and he was fascinated by it. And I thought, this is the guy. Like, this is... You know, I never got his name or anything, and I can't remember the encounter very much, but I remember he had the bear pelt set up on these stairs. So cool.
And then you came back and you said, aha, I think I know what to do here.
Yeah, yeah.
And the story of Luca the Butcher, who we meet early on, and he's angry, mean, vicious wife beater, and then we learn about his story. How did that story emerge?
That emerged because I thought the way I was approaching his character for myself was quite simplistic. I knew that I wanted him to be a villain, and what faster way to make somebody a villain than to, you know, make him hit his wife and, like, terrorize this child by telling him he's going to eat his feet like a little pig, you know, which was the association when the grandfather meets him in the butcher shop. I was quite irritated with that because I remembered reading an essay Roald Dahl had written in which he said, the worse the villain, the more excited we are to see them fall. But you can't just say this guy's a villain because you yourself are not going to respond to it and nobody will. So I wrote this backstory for him that was supposed to be, you know, how Luca became a jerk. And instead, it ended up being, you know, about his lost dreams and his frustrations with having to fit into these obligations of his village, of his family, being thwarted out of every attempt that he'd made, and not excusing in any way what he ends up doing, but it gave a different perspective of him than I thought was going to be there, and I realized it belonged in the book. And then Darisha got the same treatment, and the apothecary as well. I love those moments in books that I've read simply because they round out the world. You know, they add a different dimension to the world as if it continues. When you close the book, the world goes on. And it's been happening since before you got there to that moment in the story. And it's going to continue after you leave. I love that sense. And there's actually quite a bit of it in The Master and Margarita. I mean, the whole book is peppered with all these characters with extraordinarily complicated names who have all these positions in the theater world and politics. And, you know, they're all corrupt. The other thing about that is that in the Balkans, when somebody tells you a story, you're going to get the background of the minor character, because there's no such thing as a story in which you went around the corner to buy a loaf of bread. Like, you went around the corner to buy a loaf of bread and you met this guy and you know the secrets about his family. And as you're on the way back from the corner store, you're going to tell the first person you meet whom you know that you met this guy, and you're going to tell them the story of his family with some embellishments. So I think it comes from that as well.
Thea Obrecht, did your grandfather grow up in a small town like that?
My grandfather grew up on the outskirts of Belgrade. He was raised by his mother. He grew up in pretty poor circumstances, but not in an isolated place. One of the reasons why he was able to become an aeronautical engineer and raise himself up through schooling alone, which happened, you know, quite rarely, even in socialist, even communist, was because of his proximity to Belgrade.
The stories about World War II in the book, do those come from him as well?
Some come from my grandmother. A lot of it is just imagination run wild. Both my grandparents were alive during World War II, so they had some stuff to say about what it was like to be under that particular occupying energy.
Thea Obrecht, you lived for a while in Cairo. What was that like?
Oh, it was incredible. That was a wild, wild childhood. I was a history nerd before because I loved things told to me through story. It was the only way I could absorb them, but for sure afterwards. I mean, that was... It doesn't get much better than, you know, having your history teacher at the end of the unit on Egyptian mythology take you out to the site of Memphis, which is the city lost under the sand, on horseback to tell you about it some more, you know, while you sit there on the scene. I mean, that was just incredible.
If you're living in Cairo, how far were you from the pyramids?
It was about a 45-minute drive. We were in Cairo, and the pyramids are in Giza, which is across the water and like a little bit that way. We would go there every other weekend.
Really?
Yeah, and it was something that, you know, you pull up, there they are, go for a walk, then you go for tea. I mean, it was crazy, and I feel so lucky to have had that as part of my childhood.
How about getting down to some of the other sites a little bit further away?
There were a couple of oases that we would go to, you know, regularly, because they were always finding stuff. You know, there was always, oh, you know, they've got this new tomb up, you know, up at the Wadi, so let's go. And we go there and just, we took a big Nile River cruise when we knew we were leaving. And it was my grandpa, my mom, and me. My grandma didn't come. My grandmother was very much in awe of the history there, and she's a very spiritual person, and certain things made her uncomfortable. She was like, these are people's graves. You can't do that. But we took a cruise from Luxor to Aswan, and then went down to Abu Simbel, like, and just saw all the massive temples, and it was amazing. And I was dying of chicken pox, but I didn't care.
What languages do you speak now?
I speak Serbo-Croatian, which I guess Serbian and Croatian, and I speak English and a little bit of French. I have, you know, a good grasp of French, and if people speak it to me slowly enough, I got it.
And in Cairo, everything was in English then?
I went to an English school. I knew some Arabic, and I can pull words when I hear people speaking it around me, but nowhere near at the level that I could have.
Well, when you were in Cyprus, were you on the Greek side or the Turkish side?
The Greek side. And I remember being sort of unaware, you know, because we went from tension to tension. It was, you know, ethnic tensions in the Balkans and then ethnic tensions in Cyprus. And I remember going to a store. I had just read The Chronicles of Narnia, and Edmund's downfall there is Turkish Delight, you know, which is this, like, super sweet, like, gooey candy. And I was like, I wonder what Turkish Delight is, and so curious about it. So I went to the store where they sold sweets and asked for Turkish Delight. And the woman said, honey, here it's Cyprus Delight. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize.
Well, now you've been in the United States, and you saw, well, you were very young, but you heard about and saw ethnic tension in Yugoslavia. You saw it in Cyprus. You saw some tensions in Cairo, certainly, and we've seen them explode in the past year or two. Now you're in the United States. When you look at the American political scene and the extreme right wing here in America, are you seeing connections, or do you think it's somewhat different?
I think it's somewhat different. But I think that at its base, human conflict is always the same. The danger in it is that it can always be muscled into people. The hatred can always be muscled into people by a very glib few individuals in high ranks who, you know, somehow always manage to insert that seed of tension and then get out without having to deal with the consequences.
Well, when you go back to Yugoslavia and now Serbia, how do people relate to the madness and the genocides that occurred 15, 20 years ago?
A lot of my generation is quite tired. There's this sense of wanting to move on and see what's better, because one of the things that frustrates them is that the educational system in the Balkans is quite amazing. And there are these people coming out of universities on just such high levels of education, with proficiency in everything from, you know, nuclear physics to language and architecture, and finding themselves in droves out of work. And I think that there's this idea of wanting to move past the things that happened that keep us back.
Is there still tremendous anger from the Muslims toward the Christians, or from the Christians toward the Muslims?
There's tremendous anger in small pockets always. And I'm always surprised by the people that it comes from, because it's something like a 90-10 or an 80-20 ratio of people who say, just live and let live. And then, you know, those people who... like the guy who drives your taxi cab, and then he'll say something, you know, and your jaw will hit the floor. Or, you know, the guy at customs who says, you know, why are you trying to come in with an American passport? Don't you have another one? And really, you know, really aggressive. But those people are few and far between, and yet their anger is so potent that it makes you afraid.
What do you think brought about that outpouring of war? I mean, Yugoslavia, when your parents were growing up, was a very peaceful place. Yeah. It was considered, at least over here, as being the part of the, quote, communist world that was open to us. We could go there.
Yeah.
And it was perfectly fine in relation to the rest of what we saw. It was an open and free and peaceful society.
Yeah, and very tolerant of those ethnic differences. My grandfather was a Roman Catholic Slovenian who married a Bosnian Muslim. My grandma, you know, celebrates the Muslim holidays and, you know, and occasionally fasts for Ramadan. And that's just how it was, even though she would then cook like a really big meal for Christmas. You know, she didn't care. I don't know. I think that it always comes down to the few with the power and the agenda and the voice being able to rally people's dreams and beliefs and summon up as much hatred as possible, and those people with a very seductive promise of the future at one another, and then get away without paying for it.
Is there that much difference then between a Rick Santorum or Michelle Bachmann and these people then?
The unifying concept that's dangerous there is the fact that all the time you're being fed this idea that a difference between you and somebody else really exists. And the truth is that when the dust clears, if there's ever a skirmish and the dust clears, you realize, well, those differences were actually quite small, and what did we just do? And anybody who fuels that fire is really dangerous, and it always ends the same way.
Thea Obrecht, in 2009, as you've mentioned, you went back to do a piece for Harper's on vampires. What did you find?
I found a lot of regional myths and a lot of very hospitable people and a lot of very inhospitable people who take that particular aspect of their past quite seriously, whether it's something that they live with, you know, and embrace, or something that they live with and try to shun. It's part of their identity. Some of those stories are quite beautiful. We had the opportunity to, I went with my friend. I went with two family friends in sort of a car without a map. We ended up in the house of this gentleman who was 92 or 93 years old. And he had seen a vampire when he was 16 or 17 on his way home in a village where a vampire had existed in the 1800s and, you know, sort of officially been documented as disposed of. He wanted to tell us the story about, you know, how it all went down. And while we were sitting there, and in the Balkans, when they sit you down, they always give you, like, a bunch of stuff to drink, a bunch of stuff to eat. Like, you can't hear a story without proper refreshments. When we were sitting there, I became aware of the presence of his whole family who lived in the house with him. You know, his daughter, who's older than my grandmother, his granddaughter, his great-great-grandson, who was like in his little teddy bear jammies running around. And they had all sort of gathered to hear this story, which they'd heard, you know, a million times if they'd heard it once. But it was part of this man's identity and this family's identity that in this village that had the history of vampirism, he had seen a vampire, and this was to be taken seriously. And it was quite beautiful and really sort of changed the way I thought about the book and about village life, this idea of story as identity. That's what it is.
Is there any relationship between these vampire stories and, let's say, Vampire Diaries, Buffy, Breaking Dawn, Anne Rice?
No, one of the reasons why they sent me was to find out whether there was any similarities and differences because, as you mentioned, there's a trend towards vampires now. They're actually very different. A vampire in the Balkans, it's a dead body reanimated, and it's going to give you a disease. You know, the theory is that vampirism in the Balkans emerged because of an improper assessment of decomposing rates and, decomposing processes. So the vampire there is always, you know, this gruesome, hideous thing. It's going to get you. Much like zombies here, there's no reasoning with a vampire. You can't say, oh, don't you feel guilty about this? And let me give you some cow blood through a IV bag. And anything can be a vampire. You know, they got watermelon vampires. I'm not kidding. There's some vampire watermelons. You don't become a vampire by sucking, you know, by having another vampire suck your blood. You become a vampire if a cat jumps over your grave. You know, if you were a bad person in life, dog, you know, pees in the vicinity of your gravesite, you become a vampire. Like, it's all these strange things, and, you know, vampire and ghost are synonymous. You're just this walking disease. Come back to haunt the living. So, no, it has nothing to do with vampires here.
But what it does have to do, as you say, in a book like The Tiger's Wife, is it creates what I see, as you're talking, this very, very strong link between this book, let's say, and any book that deals with magic realism, because what you're doing is the past becomes mythology.
True. And how you see it then becomes reality. And the way you accept that reality, you know, says something about you, the character, or you, the reader. And that's how it ended up.
Well, as with Natalia, not delving too far into the validity or falseness of this, did you feel the same way in talking about the vampires?
To some degree, but it also became very difficult to delve into the truth because there's only so far you can go. And the person telling you the story has an agenda. In some places, everybody was determined to let it. I mean, we had found this watermill where supposedly this vampire, Sava Savanovich, had been killing millers in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And everybody on that road where we were looking for the watermill told us there's absolutely no such thing here. I have no idea what you're talking about. We found the watermill, and we found the chapel in front of it, and we found the stakes inside it, you know? So, no way. But the story that's told is that's not the watermill. There's a different watermill. There's no such story here, you know? And so with some places, you hit a roadblock, you know, the way people perceived it stonewalled you in delving too deep into the truth. To some degree, it doesn't matter, which I also learned was all right.
One final question about the former Yugoslavia today. How peaceful is it now?
Depends, always. Some people are quite at peace. Some people are not. Depends on country to country and, you know, area of the country to area of the country. There's always people who would go right back out and pick up a gun, and there's people who just want to live their lives and, you know, take a vacation whenever they can and make a better country for their children that has jobs in it. It depends on people's preoccupations.
Is it harder to travel, say, to the seaside from Serbia now than it was?
It's not. It's actually much easier. A lot of tourism, Serbia to Croatia, exists. There's people who sometimes just won't go. There's people who will make you uncomfortable once you get there. But, you know, again, they're few and far between.
Tia Obrecht, now The Tiger's Wife is out. It's won awards. Are you working on another novel?
I am, slowly but surely. I'm most concerned with doing a good job in the next one as its own entity with its own obsessions and its own project, so that I don't just bounce out of this one and into the next one superficially. One of the roadblocks in it is thinking that it's going to happen the way it did last time, that the process is going to work the same way. And I think that I've finally sort of made my peace with the fact that it's not. You know, you got to find something that you actually care about, because that was the one thing that really can carry over from the last one. You know, my grandfather died. I ended up having a story to tell about it. That, for better or for worse, has some integrity in my own life. So that has to be in the next one, too, however it comes about.
You've been listening to an interview with Taya Obrecht, whose novel The Tiger's Wife is out in trade paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.